Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
On today's podcast, we roll back the clock some 4.5 centuries and take you to the world of colonial Peru to look at what happened when two distinct religious cultures met, Christianity and indigenous Incan beliefs. Whereas one would often expect such a meeting of two civilizations, especially in the 16th century, to have its fair share of violence and conflict, this may not always be the case, as such cultural intermingling can be filled with nuanced and complex power relationships. Such nuance and complexity is well reflected in the life and writings of Jesuit missionary named Blas Valera, who was himself the product of a mix of cultures, being of both Spanish and Incan lineage, a mestizo as they were known. Moreover, Padre Valera's interactions with the indigenous population of the Peruvian highlands was not only about evangelizing, but also about studying and understanding ancient Incan religious traditions. My guest today, Sabina Highland, an associate professor of anthropology at St. Norbert College in De Pere, Wisconsin, has written extensively on colonial Peru, with specific attention to the role of the Jesuits and Blas Valera in particular. She is the author of numerous books, including The Quito Manuscript, An Inca History Preserved, The Jesuits and the Incas, An Extraordinary Life of Padre Blas Valera, and most recently, God of the Andes, an early Jesuit account of Inca religion and Andean Christianity, which provides a translation of one of Blas Valera's writings, a writing that helped get him in a bit of trouble with the colonial powers that be, both religious and secular. Now, as always, we have links to these books and the author's webpage on our website, so please visit us at www.researchonreligion.org to learn more. And while you're there, like us on your Facebook page or spread the word about us on your other social media channels. Sabina, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hi, Tony.
One thing I should mention here is that Professor Highland is the second guest that we have had from St. Norbert College, the first being Mark Vanderer. Now, whereas my goal here is to provide a wide diversity of scholars from different universities and different fields of studies, it is rather something to have a relatively small liberal arts college such as St. Norbert's represented twice. They must be doing something right up there in northeastern Wisconsin other than producing Super Bowl champions to generate some fine scholarship.
Well, thank you. St. Norbert really is a great college, and I have wonderful colleagues. I feel very blessed to be here.
Well, that's pretty cool. And how's the winter weathers? Do you get used to those?
No.
Okay. So if they move that down to Florida or something, it would be much better.
Yeah. Well, even a little warmer would be nice.
Yeah. Okay. I should also note here that Sabina is the first anthropologist we've had on the show. And for those of you who may not be all that familiar with the different academic disciplines, the study of anthropology tends to focus on the understanding of human cultures, the different ideas, traditions, values, and norms that societies develop and maintain. And this is a little bit different than my field as a political economist. And so I want to start with a little bit of what we'd call inside baseball talk here by getting your reflection on an important methodological topic regarding how we scholars study the things that we study and know the things that we know. And I bring this point up as well because your own research on Blas Valera, a Jesuit who, while being a mestizo, is studying an Incan religion from the eyes of a Christian. And now, one of the main critiques that I have been confronted with in my own work on Latin American religion is that an outside observer of a culture often tends to have a skewed view or perhaps a lack of subtle understanding of their research subjects. In many ways, and I think this is partially correct, we tend to bring our own cultural biases into the field, and viewing other societies through that prism may distort our vision of what is true to that culture. But on the other hand, I feel that an outsider's perspective is often useful in research because you can oftentimes see interesting aspects of a culture that insiders tend to take for granted or have not investigated. Given your anthropological background, where you really get into the study of cultures, what are your thoughts on this topic? How does this tension, if it's a tension at all, affect your research?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, anthropologists spend a lot of time thinking about that. How can we ever know another culture? Is it possible for an outsider to know another culture? Do insiders have a better view? At this point, I think most anthropologists would agree that while outsiders never have a perfect understanding of another culture, we can come close. But I think that this understanding was more difficult in the 16th century than today. Today, for example, if I do field work in a remote part of the Andes, the people I'm working with have some knowledge of global culture. For example, 2 months ago, I was in a small, very remote village located about 12,000 feet, participating in a sacred ritual to the mountain gods in the only remaining temple in the Andes dedicated exclusively to the worship of Andean deities. And yet the specialist leading the offering, you know, had a cell phone, he watched TV, he traveled to Lima. So there's much less of a distance now, or there's more common ground, I think. In the 16th century, in the early days after the Spanish conquest of the Incas in 1532, it was very different. The world of the Spanish and of the Andean peoples were radically distinct, very incommensurate in many ways. Now, Valera, as a mestizo, half Spanish, half Indian, was both insider and outsider to each world. And so I think that he has uniquely valuable perspectives that he can offer us.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really liked about the book, and that the topic caught my attention, was that Valera himself tends to be a double mirror in some ways, that he looks through the prism of different religions twice, and he really kind of sees what each culture offers. And as we noticed, he'll come up with some very intriguing conclusions that got him in a bit of trouble in that. So
I love the phrase double mirror. I wish I thought of that.
Yeah, well, you got to contact me early on. So that's, I'm good with coming up with phrases, not explaining things, but coming up with clever turns of phrases, I guess. So you were up in the highlands then observing some of these ancient rituals at 12,000 feet in the air, huh?
Yeah. This was in a community called Rapaz.
Mm-hmm.
And the Incas, their writing was on knotted strings, which we still cannot decipher. And this is one of the few communities that have their knotted strings. They're called quipus, and they have them in the sacred temple. And they believe that their rituals have to be done in presence of the quipus, because the quipus act as the messengers to the gods. Mm. And it was a very powerful moment being there.
And it is pretty neat to think that we here in the 21st century, with all our scientific knowledge and personal computers and smartphones, can figure out what seemingly is a very simple technique of just tying knots onto strings.
Seemingly,
yeah.
Is the key word. They're very complex instruments,
yeah.
And I know I've been studying them. I've had the good fortune. One of the reasons why we haven't been able to decipher them so far is that we've never found before a text where you had both the knotted strings and then the written equivalent.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had the good fortune recently to find one of those texts in another very remote town in the Andes, and I'm going to be studying it to see if it can help us understand what these knotted strings were.
Again, this is taking us a little bit away from our topic, but I'm just fascinated.
Yeah, sorry.
No, this is fine, because this is the stuff that I'm really interested in, and I hope our listeners will just bear with me for a minute. But you said you found a text that helps you interpret these strings. I mean, how did you find it? Was it in a bookstore? Did you, trip on it on your way to the market? Would you dig it up in, mason jars
there
in the backyard, or what?
You know, it's funny, because the Jesuits, who are wonderful, and I love the Jesuits, they get all the press. But there was another order in Peru in the early days, the Mercedarians, and they developed these bilingual texts to use in catechesis. So it'd be a board, and you'd have quipu strings and then writing next to it. And we knew these existed. And there was one that had existed in a town called Mangas that was observed in the 1980s. And a Peruvian anthropologist named Roman actually did a brief report on it. But that one disappeared. And I contacted some people in the town to see if they had any memory of it. And a local school teacher, several years before, had been helping to clean out the colonial church, and in an old chest she found another one of these quipu boards, as we call them. And she invited me to come up, and I went to visit her in January, and then I just had another trip there in July. Some of the writing is obscured by bat urine, actually, because there were bats in the church.
Yeah.
And so a multispectral imaging specialist named Gene Ware came in, and he was able to scan the board, and hopefully we'll be able to recover the lost parts of the writing there.
Yeah, that's some pretty fancy stuff. So you get into the whole archaeology and using those scanner kind of technology things.
Yeah, but you know, doing it in a town, the whole time we were there, there was no electricity, for example.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, we had a generator.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. So I'm going to dub you the Indiana Jones of St. Norbert College.
Well, thank you. If only that were true.
I'm going to go ahead and get us back on track now and talking a little bit about Padre Blas Valera. But before we do that, he was a Jesuit priest that was born and lived in Peru during the latter half of the 16th century. So from roughly the 1540s, and I think he died just before the turn of the century in 1597 or 98. Now, I want to set the historical table for our listeners, since a lot of people might not be familiar with the Peru of the 1500s. And there are two separate aspects of that history at the time that I think are relevant. The first is the Spanish conquest of the Incan Empire, and the second is the rise of the Jesuits as a Catholic religious order, which was going on at roughly the same time. So let's go ahead and start with the former, and if you could, give us some background about the meeting of Spanish and Incan civilizations in the early 1500s.
Yeah, the meeting of Spanish and Incan civilizations, and of course that's a big topic. The Incas were conquered, as the standard's history goes. The Incas were conquered by the Spanish in 1532 by a Spaniard named Francisco Pizarro, who was an illiterate Spaniard who had spent years in the Spanish Main, the Caribbean, looking to make his fortune. We believe that he probably heard rumors of the existence of the Inca Empire, and he went with his soldiers. He was able to meet the emperor, Atahualpa, to capture him, and then slowly begin the process of taking over the empire. Now, the Incas, of course, were the largest Native American empire ever to exist in the New World. They had 15 to 20 million inhabitants. So people wonder, how could the Spanish have ever taken them over?
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's probably a longer story than I have time to tell here, but it has to do in part with European diseases that had caused terrible epidemics throughout Peru, even before Francisco Pizarro stepped foot in the Andes. Smallpox was brought probably by shipwrecked Portuguese sailors off the coast of South America. The Spanish were very, very astute in playing off political divisions in Indian polities, Indian kingdoms. There were a lot of people and a lot of Indians who were happy to overthrow the Incas.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of divisions within the Inca royal family, and the Spanish played those off beautifully and wound up in charge of Spanish America. But religion had a huge role in the conquest as well. The Spanish crown was very concerned with the morality of the conquest. There was highly developed just war theory. And so, you know, there's a whole long history of all the debates about whether the conquest was just or not, efforts that the Spanish crown made to make it just. And there was a lot of disagreement in the Spanish church about the best way to bring the conquered Indians to Christianity. But everyone at the time agreed, everyone in Europe agreed on the necessity of having the Christians become Christians.
Mm-hmm.
It was felt that this is what justified the conquest, to bring Christianity, to bring the gospel to the Americas.
And that's pretty much, you know, standard fare for the time. You have conquest, mm-hmm. and you take your religion in. And again, the fact that you point out that the crown was concerned about just war theory, we often don't think about that. But, you know, as we find out in talking about some of the religious figures that were there in the time a little bit later on, that there was this concern about just war theory, about what are we doing? It's not just going in and clubbing and taking over.
Absolutely. And there were, you know, the brother of Francisco Pizarro, when he went back to Spain, he was put in prison because of the killing of Atahualpa. The Spanish crown was very unhappy about that. And there were new laws put into place to help protect the rights of the Indians. It was taken very seriously.
Let me go ahead now and talk about the other aspect of the story. That's the presence of the Jesuits. And again, at the time of the conquest, the Jesuits were a relatively new religious order, having been recognized by Pope Paul III in 1540. So we're talking simultaneously the conquest going on and the religious order rising and then finally being recognized in 1540. So give us a bit of background about the Jesuits, who they were and what were they doing in the Americas, given that they were such a new religious order?
Yeah, you know, from the very beginning, the Jesuits had overseas missions. As you say, they were founded by St. Ignatius Loyola in 1540. When the Jesuits arrived in Peru in 1568, they were late on the scene. Other orders like the Franciscans, the Mercedarians, the Dominicans had already carved out a lot of the mission territory for themselves. And the Jesuits, you know, they had a new type of religious ideal. They didn't want to take permanent missions. They would end up doing so in some cases, but they didn't really want to. They wanted to have kind of these traveling preaching circuits lasting a couple of months where they would go and inspire people and renew their Christianity. So a lot of their time, their early years in Peru, were focused on having these preaching missions through Indian territory. And they were renowned for their preaching and also for their skills at hearing confession, which they considered very important. Mm-hmm. Penance was very central to Jesuit spirituality.
Now, one of the interesting things about the Jesuits, and I went to a Jesuit college, one of your rivals down the road in Wisconsin, Marquette University, so I got to learn a little bit about these folks. But one of the interesting things I learned about the Jesuits was their relative independence from secular power, specifically in the Americas. And in part, I think this was that they were a religious order that was founded after the various concordats and agreements that were negotiated between Spain in the late 1400s and early 1500s with the Vatican. What we call the patronato real, or the royal patronage system, tended to set the relationship between the church and the state in motion there, but the Jesuits come after this, and they were really never part of the contract that was inked in between these two. So to what extent were the Jesuits either tied to the secular power structure in colonial America, or were they independent? Am I reading the situation right?
I think that a lot of Jesuits today perhaps can have maybe a rosy-colored view of some of their early history.
Mm-hmm.
They were, in fact, under the Patronato Real.
Oh, they were
under the royal patronage. They weren't juridically independent of the secular structure. They often tried to influence, as best they could, the secular church. When the Jesuits were founded in late 16th century, many other branches of the church, in particular the Spanish Inquisition, felt very threatened by them. And the Jesuits were given various powers, various independence from the Spanish Inquisition, and in Spain, the Spanish Inquisition went to a lot of effort to try to suppress the Jesuits. And this is something that would affect Blas Valera's story, because throughout the later part of the 16th century, from the 1580s to 1600, that 20-year period, the Jesuits in Peru were told that they had to not criticize Spanish abuses against the Indians, not criticize the secular government. They had to toe the line so as not to give their enemies any excuse for suppressing them. So this is a little different than the normal Jesuit view of their own history. But in fact, you know, we have all the internal letters and internal legislation and so on, where we see that this was the Jesuits' policy as regard the secular state in this period. Later, of course, it would change.
Yeah, that's interesting what you say about the Jesuits there. I mean, they're somewhat of a uppity denomination, as you would say. And in part, later on they get kicked out of the Americas. And I'm just wondering to what extent that, you know, being a new religious order, you had that fervency that was associated with being new. What's your thought on that?
Well, I think they had pretty high standards for the people that they accepted. They had very strong emphasis on education. And, you know, I think that was certainly something that was positive. And, of course, when they arrived in Peru, because they were new, the viceroy thought that they would become, you know, the right hand of the viceroy.
Mm-hmm.
And when they didn't, that wasn't appreciated either.
Yeah. That brings me to the question of the relationship between religion and political power in the Americas. Because it's often assumed that the Catholic Church and its representatives, such as the Jesuits or the Mercedarians or other religious orders or just the regular secular clergy, that they were closely tied to the secular powers and served as a means of breaking down and repressing the indigenous population. So much like the viceroy says, oh, great, these Jesuits are coming in. They're my right-hand man. They're another part of my arsenal of tools for keeping the population subjugated. However, you know, when I studied this on my own and looked at this time period, I found that this really wasn't the case. And one could easily point to Bishop Bartolomé de las Casas as perhaps the primary or most famous example of a Catholic clergy member who fought hard to protect the interests of the indigenous population. And he was in Mesoamerica, or what we'd consider present-day Mexico, Guatemala, Central America region. So what is your take on that religion and secular power relationship? Were there clergy like de las Casas in the Andean region, or is it just one or two?
Again, that's a great question, because I think there are a lot of misunderstandings out there and stereotypes. Certainly there were clergy like Las Casas in the Andes. I think Valera was a Las Casas of the Andes in many ways. You know, the problem is that people like to assume, I think, that the Catholic Church in the 16th century was a monolith, you know, whereas in fact it was really diverse. You had priests who completely supported the program of the conquest. You had priests who were corrupt, but then you had priests who went to great efforts to protest against the abuses of the Indians and to try to find ways to ameliorate their suffering or to actually, you know, change their status. And, you know, Valera was not alone in saying that the conquest, the Spanish conquest of the Americas, was unjust, and that Native peoples deserve to have more of a say in their lives than they were given. There were certainly others.
Yeah, my take on that is that subject, too, is that especially in the early days of the conquest, in the 1500s, mid-1500s, the clergy who generally came over from Spain at this time, or who were ordained in the Americas, typically did not do this because they were interested in political power. If you were a priest interested in political power, you stayed in Spain because it was a much more comfortable life. It's the folks who did come over. They say, oh, there's a new territory of souls that are worth saving, of converting. Those are really devout folks. And when they get over there and they see the mistreatment of many of the indigenous population by the conquistadores, they say, whoa, 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 we cannot convert people when you're beating them. This is not how Christ would have done this. Let's back up and take things a little bit slower here.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. That was very much the case. A lot of these men came over because they wanted to sacrifice their lives for Christ. They wanted to, you know, they lived under conditions of great hardship because of their Christian ideals. And of course, you also, but they weren't all that way, too. You know, you had some who came over because they thought they'd make it rich.
Yep, that's true.
Gold. You had others who came over because nobody in Europe really wanted them around. But for the most part, I think what you're saying is absolutely true.
Well, let's go ahead now and turn our attention to Blas Valera. And he's been the subject of your books and your writings for many years now. And as you mentioned, he seems to be the Bartolomé de las Casas of the Andean region. And it's good that you're bringing a great deal of attention to him, because I found his writings and his take on the entire situation to be very, very interesting. But the first thing that I really need to ask you about is his name, Blas. I mean, I have never encountered this particular given name in all my studies of Spanish. So what can you say about this name, Blas?
Yeah, the name Blas. I mean, it is a name that you see in 16th century. There are some other writers named Blas, like there's a Mercedarian, Blas de Atienza. It's the Spanish version of the English name Blaise. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if maybe Blas got that name because maybe he was born on St. Blaise's or San Blas's feast day.
Wait a minute here. There's a St. Blaise's feast day?
Yeah, there's a St. Blaise feast day. It's February 3rd, the day after Candlemas, and I know I used to live in Kansas, and St. Blaise's feast day was always a big deal there, because St. Blaise was considered, at least in local tradition, to be the patron of diseases of the throat. And after Mass on St. Blaise's feast day, we would all line up, and one by one, the priest would hold the candles the new candles from Candlemas over our throats and say a blessing so that we would be protected from any diseases of the throats for that year.
Hmm. See, that's why I like doing this Research on Religion podcast series, because there's always something new that I learn. I mean, I'm learning a lot of stuff about Blaise Valera, but the other thing is that I never knew that there was a patron saint of diseases of the throat.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's official or not. That was just the folk belief.
Okay, well, I guess so. And it kind of came, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, in February, and that's the time when everybody's getting colds and flus, I guess, so that tends to make sense there. So, okay, well, February 3rd, I'm going to be celebrating St. Blaise Day.
Oh, good.
So tell us about this guy. Tell us about Blas, and we're pronouncing his name in Spanish or in Castilian as Blas Valera. When was this guy born, and what was his life growing up as a kid?
Well, he was born in 1544, we believe, and he was born in rather a remote part of the Peruvian colonial viceroyalty at the time. It's called Chachapoyas. It's high-altitude jungle. And his father, Luis, was a very powerful encomendero. That's somebody who's been given grants of free Indian labor. And his mother was an Indian woman. We don't know too much about her. We think she was probably Inca because of how she raised Blas to speak Inca Quechua. Quechua was the language of the Inca Empire. And, you know, of course, people who lived 400 years ago, we don't know as much as we would like about them. But we know that by the time he was a teenager, he was sent to be educated on the Peruvian coast. And there he apparently spent many hours with they're called amautas, the learned men of the executed Emperor Inca Atahualpa. And he apparently spent many hours with them learning a lot about Inca history and Inca traditions. And then eventually he studied in Lima, and for whatever reasons he decided in 1568, the year that the Jesuits arrived in Peru, that he wanted to be a Jesuit. He didn't want to go home to Chachapoyas.
That's rather interesting for me, and that's a part of the tale as I was reading your book, just trying to figure out what was going on in his head at the time. Now, it sounded like he was raised by his mother. His father was probably there, but his mother had a lot of influence to teach somebody a language like that. You have to have a lot of contact with a young son. Mm-hmm. So you get a lot of respect for the culture, but then all of a sudden he wants to become a Jesuit. I mean, for me, it's a very interesting blend of cultures at that period of time, which shows you the intermingling of these two and the fact that somebody, he would have been in his late teens, early 20s at about this time, mm-hmm. that he goes ahead and says, yeah, I want to do that. What's your thoughts there?
Well, I think there must have been something about the Jesuits that appealed to him. They're preaching their work among the Indians. But to some degree, he didn't necessarily have a choice if he wanted to be a missionary.
Mm.
The Franciscans, the Dominicans, they did not allow men of Indian descent to join their orders. The Mercedarians were the only ones who did. The Jesuits, when they arrived in Peru, they wanted to found the order on mestizos. They thought that these men who are half Indian, half Spanish would be the best evangelists of Christianity, because they would know their mother's culture, they would know their mother's language, but they would also be very firm in their Christianity from their father's heritage. And so I think that's why. Now, eventually, within 14 years, the Jesuits would vote unanimously against having any men of Indian descent into their order. That ruling would stand up until the time they were kicked out of South America in the 18th century. And some of the Jesuits at the time said that it was because of Blas Valera that they took that decision.
So this adds a little bit of air of mystery to our story, and we're going to kind of move there, what happens with this Blas Valera guy. But it is an interesting take. So it's not so much that Blas Valera was rushing out to seek the Jesuits, but it might have also well been the case that the Jesuits were rushing to seek him, or at least people like him, and given his educational background, he was prime candidate number one for recruitment to the Jesuit order.
Yeah, and it should be mentioned, I mean, he stayed loyal to the Jesuits his whole life. Later on in his life, he was given the opportunity to leave, and he refused.
Hmm.
So there must have been something there that about Loyola's spirituality that I think he loved.
And really connected with. Yes, because now as we move on to his later life, we're going to find out that he led a pretty hard scrabble life after this, in part because of some of his investigations and some of his thoughts and some of his writings. But let's go ahead and take it from the point now that he enters the Jesuit seminary and says, I'm going to be a Jesuit. What's his professional life like here? Was he an ardent missionary? Was he one of these Crusader for Christ types, shock troops of the Vatican, or what?
Well, he was certainly very ardent, I think, and dedicated. I don't know if a Crusader for Christ type would be quite the way to call him. He was in various missions, Indian missions that the Jesuits had in Peru, but when he was there, and we can tell from his writings, he spent a lot of time talking to the older men in the communities, and again, finding out about their religious traditions, finding out all he could about the religious philosophy of the Inca people and the Andean peoples. And, you know, the Jesuits, when they got to Peru, they thought this was great. They thought that the Andean peoples would convert quickly to Christianity, and you know, there wouldn't be any problem. It was only later that they began to realize, by the 1580s, that this conversion wasn't going smoothly, that many of the Indians they felt claimed to be Christian but still continued their ancient practices,
mm-hmm.
that the Jesuits' attitudes changed and they began to clamp down much more harshly on any type of native custom. So in the early days, I think Valera was celebrated, his skill in languages was praised, and he was able to, you know, move around the countryside learning about traditions. Also, I should mention, he was eventually sent to Cusco, which is the old Inca capital. And there in Cusco, he had weekly spiritual discussions every Wednesday night with a group of Inca noblemen. And one of them, actually, we know was the in charge of the wardrobe of the Inca emperor previously. And I think a lot of his ideas about who the Incas were, about the similarities, the points of contact between Inca religion and Christianity were developed in these spiritual discussions.
Let's go ahead and talk about the content of those discussions before we turn to the fact that the Jesuits start to change their minds on everything. Because I think what Blas Valera sees in his discussions with these tribal leaders in Cusco really influence his particular theological thoughts, which become problematic for the Jesuits. So what did Valera find about the Incans, or more generally, what was Incan religion like at this time?
Wow. Well, you know, obviously, his views are very complex. Clearly, he's very sympathetic to Inca religion. And, you know, of course, in my book, I go into this in detail, discussing Valera's vision of Andean Christianity. Valera thought that the Incas had been chosen by God to prepare the way for Christianity in the Andes. He believed that many central aspects of Inca faith were compatible with Christianity. For example, he argued that the Incas worshipped the supreme creator god, Ilia Texi. Name means divine origin, who's similar to, or really the same as, the God of the Old Testament. He argued that most Inca rituals were divinely instituted and were in fact, you know, again, compatible with Christianity. For example, the Incas had the rite of confession, and they also had forms of monasticism, again, which Valera felt was compatible with Andean Christianity.
Give us an idea of what that looked like, because, again, our vision of Incan religion is somehow clouded by our Western view of the world that's been presented to us. And so when I was reading through your book, the fact that Valera found these rites of confession and of monasticism, I'm kind of going, wow, I had really never known that. The one thing that really clicked to my mind about Incan religions or the indigenous religions of what becomes Latin America was human sacrifice. That's the image that we have here. So what did the Incan religion look like at that time?
Yeah, well, you know, these are things, of course, that anthropologists debate among themselves. The Incas had a tradition of human sacrifice, and according to many of the Spanish writers of the 16th century, the humans were sacrificed in fairly large numbers. For example, it's claimed that when, you know, there are systems of shrines outside of Cusco on these lines, and there's over 300 of them. and it was claimed that many children were sacrificed every year at each one of these shrines. And so I think a lot of people have thought that. Now, Valera claims that there was no human sacrifice in the Inca Empire, and he says that the belief that there was is due to a language misunderstanding. The Spaniards didn't understand the subtlety and metaphorical nature of Quechua, and so he said the Incas would sacrifice animals but refer to them as humans. So they were sacrificing animals in the place of humans. And Valera argues this was misunderstood by other Spanish writers. One thing that sheds light on this is archaeology. Johann Reinhardt has found a number of bodies of young women and young men who were sacrificed to the mountain gods. So there was some human sacrifice, but in general, archaeologists have not found evidence of these large-scale human sacrifices. For example, the archaeologist Brian Bauer, who charted out the sacred shrine system called Seques around Cusco, he found virtually no evidence of any human sacrifice. So the emerging thinking now is that the prevalence of human sacrifice in the Inca Empire has been very much over-exaggerated and very much misunderstood. And it seems that Valera was probably on the right track in saying that most of the time it didn't really happen.
And so how about some of these other rituals or practices as well? The one thing that is fascinating to me is the rites of confession, which, you know, indicates that there's some concept of what we in the West would call sin, and that one, by confessing their sins, could perhaps be washed of those sins. Is that what Valera found in terms of the rites of confession for the Incas?
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, the confession was ubiquitous, and Andean confession with Andean shamans or Andean priests continues well into, you know, the late 16th century. And yes, there was an idea of sin, but it was a little different than our own. The idea was that if a person committed sins, that the gods would punish the whole community. So one's private confession was actually a public, a civic act, and you were supposed to confess your sins at least once a year. And the confession would take place usually outside by a river. The person making the confession would hold ichu grass, just the local grass, and at the end of it, to symbolize freeing themselves of sins, they would throw the grass into the water. And they would also be given penances by the priest who heard their confession. And one other thing is that in many parts of the Andes, apparently, women would confess only to women, female confessors. There was an idea that they would understand, I guess, the nature of women's sins better than men would.
And these were public events, public confessions?
They were private.
They were private. Okay. Mm-hmm. But they're still done by a river, and I guess was there a certain holiday time of the year that everybody did this? That's, you know.
There were certain times of year where it was common.
Okay.
And the Inca emperor himself, famously, he did not confess to a priest. He would go into seclusion by the Temple of the Sun in Cusco, and he would confess his sins privately to the sun god directly.
Now, was the Incan emperor considered the highest priest?
That's an interesting question. He certainly was considered very sacred, mm-hmm. but the high priest of the sun, who was the most important religious leader, the Vilakumu, he was usually a brother of the. He was usually a relative of the emperor.
For me, that is a rather interesting phenomena, because I've always been fascinated by why governments wouldn't become theocracies and the highest leader would become the highest representative of God on earth. There seems to be that specialization there, and this is the political economist in me coming out thinking about specialized tasks via Adam Smith or something, that you have two separate individuals and two separate hierarchies or bureaucracies or clergy, I guess, to manage all this kind of stuff. And that one of the other things that you mentioned too, that the Incans had that Valera thought was relatively common to Western Christianity, was the idea of monasticism. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, just to back up a second, about I agree with you. I think that the job of emperor was too big to also be in charge of the sun cult.
Yeah, it's just the fact of life, right? You can't do both religion and secular ruling at the same time. It's kind of best to separate.
But one thing that it seems that the sun priest, the Vilakumu, also had some sort of military role and was very important in helping to determine military strategy, which we wouldn't normally expect. But to answer your question about monasticism, one of the things I most love about this text is that Valera gives us glimpses into the Incan forms of Andean monasticism, which we know existed, but we know very little about. For example, we know that there were native hermits in the Andes before the arrival of Christians, but we know virtually nothing about them except what Valera tells us in this account, explaining how they lived in very remote parts of the mountains, they observed the heavens, and they were maintained by the local people who would ask them for help in practical matters, such as prayers for healthy births. So he gives these wonderful insights that we don't normally get.
And that's rather interesting, too, because you could say, well, you know, every culture has its hermits, and when you're talking millions of people in an empire, there's always going to be, you know, somebody who's antisocial, and they just take off and find their own cave and live that way. But as you mentioned, many of these folks are supported by the local community around them, and the local community sees them as a valuable part of that community. Now, are these hermits, they just kind of one-on-one they live, or are there any monastic communities, like you would say the Carmelites would be or something?
The closest thing to a monastic community, certainly in Valera's eyes, were the, these houses of chosen women, that there were women who were required to remain virgins throughout their lives, and they were enclosed in these, Valera would consider them cloisters, called Akliawasi. The women's were called Aklia, the selected one, the chosen ones. And they were chosen for their beauty. Many of them lived in these houses in Cusco or all throughout the empire, where they made very specialized cloth, and they had important ritual functions. And again, Valera gives fairly detailed descriptions of them. And of course, he's trying to argue that they're like Western Christian nuns. And so some people have questioned certain aspects of his discussion, but he tells us a lot about their lives, again, which I think we can't get from other sources, because when the Spanish arrived and they saw that, you know, the most beautiful women in the empire were locked up in these enclosures, those enclosures didn't last very long.
Yeah, that is not going to be a good mix of things, guys who've been sailing on the ocean for a long time, and yeah. So, let's talk about, I mean, are there any other aspects that Valera found rather interesting about Incan religion that also you found fascinating? We talked about monasticism here. We talked about the rites of confession and also sacrifice. But what other aspects of the religion did he pick up on?
Well, I think there's a couple that I would mention. One is the idea of death. And we know that the Incas and Andean peoples in general mummified the bodies of important individuals. And these mummified bodies were believed to still be present with us. And they were given offerings, they were spoken to, they were asked for advice. The mummified bodies of the emperors were treated as if they were still alive. They were, you know, given new clothes to wear every morning, they were fed throughout the day. And so Valera, of course, wants to make it clear that the Incas didn't worship these mummies, but there's an idea that there's a permeability of this dividing line between the living and the dead that I think is very profound and still exists in a lot of ways in Andean culture.
Mm-hmm.
Another aspect that that Valera talks about that I think is very poignant is the beautiful language. Valera talks about how Andean religious language is just filled with metaphors and very evocative imagery. And it's something that you find, for example, in some parts of Catholicism, things like the Litany of Loreto, which gives, you know, beautiful names of the Virgin Mary. But it's something that I think sometimes we can lose in our modern day understanding of the faith. And so it's very beautiful and moving for me when I read Valera's discussions of, like, the names for the supreme God and the different ways in which he's thought about as being, like, the divine origin or the sacred light.
Yeah, it is fascinating, and I've always been struck by this, by the continuity of beliefs or belief structures across wide cultures that have been separated by very vast spaces. And I'm sure this is the thing that struck Valera himself too. He says, well, these people had no contact with Europe, with no contact with the Middle East at the time of Christ. And yet there's a lot of similar aspects here. And you know, one could imagine, well, this is part, he's reading this through and interpreting it through the eyes of Christianity. But again, you know, he does have that mestizo background and is making these kind of connections here. So this is the kind of thing that he becomes fascinated with, the cultural continuities between the Incan faith and the Western European Christianity. And he starts talking about this, right? And this is forms the basis for part of his theological explanation, or at least theological worldview of what is going on here. And this is what gets him into trouble, isn't it?
Yeah, unfortunately, as I said, by the 1580s, there's a change going on in Andean Christianity and the Peruvian Church, and many church leaders, Jesuits, but others outside of the Jesuits, become concerned with the survival of Andean paganism, mm-hmm. and they begin to see this as diabolical, and so Valera gets in trouble for his ideas, arguing that, you know, Andean gods are the same as the Christian idea of God. And he, and it's very mysterious, but he gets imprisoned by the Jesuits for a number of years. He then is released under house arrest. He can't leave the Jesuit house in Lima. He can't act as a priest. He can only perform kind of low jobs around the house, like cleaning and so on. And then when his time is up of his the Jesuits, you know, we have their internal letters. They say, what do we do with him? He still holds these ideas. And so they send him to Spain because they say his ideas will cause less trouble in Spain. Unfortunately, he gets to Spain and he's in Cadiz when it's attacked by the British. And the city is sacked. The British soldiers we know, or the British sailors, went through and beat up any priest whom they found, and Valera was injured in the attack and he died somewhat later of his injuries. At least that's the story that's found in the Jesuit records.
Mm-hmm. It must have been a really interesting part of his life, or I guess interesting is not quite the right word, but a very odd part of his life is that he's worked as this time as a missionary, and then all of a sudden the last part of his life, all those doors close rather quickly. He's imprisoned. He's downplayed as an important member of the religious community. Then all of a sudden, he's sent to Spain, which is a complete foreign country to him. I mean, he's not at all. I mean, did he travel to Spain before?
No, he had never traveled to Spain before.
Yeah, and one of the things I love to do when I read history is just try to put myself in the shoes of the people that I'm reading about. And it just must have been, you know, the oddest last couple years of his life to just be living this.
I think it was difficult. I mean, he spent his time under house arrest writing. He was allowed to do that, and fortunately for us. He didn't give up his ideals, which shows, I think, how tough he was. And mm-hmm. one of the things, I don't talk about this in Gods of the Andes, it's in my other book on Valera. Apparently, one of the things that really sustained him was praying the Psalms. He became very dedicated to that, particularly to the seven penitential psalms. And there I think he found a strength that was able to get him through all of these downturns of fortune that he had to undergo.
And again, that is rather interesting, too, just from his mindset and trying to put myself into his shoes, that here he is being repressed by the Jesuits who initially welcomed him in, and yet he stays very loyal to Christianity. I mean, one could see other people, perhaps, who are have less intellectual and less emotional fortitude, saying, oh, Christianity has turned on me, I'm going to turn on Christianity as well, and give up on that. But he stays loyal to the very end to Christianity.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? And again, to the Jesuits, he was offered, you know, after his imprisonment, he was offered the chance of joining one of the, maybe, you know, the Mercedarians who were accepting mestizos, and he turned it down. He wanted to be a Jesuit. It's extraordinary.
It is fascinating. One of the aspects that I want to bring up, and I think this has a great deal of relevance for contemporary religion as well, is this issue of looking at the faiths of other cultures, seeing the similarities, and being either able to work with these, as Valera was arguing for all of his life, and that the early Jesuits, when they arrived in Peru, seemed to accept as well, saying, okay, let's work with these beliefs, let's understand what they are, let's find the similarities, versus B, of saying, no, these are pagan religions and we need to basically extricate them from the belief system of these cultures. And you know, within Catholicism, it's something that they've had to wrestle with for a long time. As they expand missionary outwards, they meet cultures that have different beliefs. And the question arises, do we work with these beliefs? Do we see the similarities? Or do we, again, try to extricate them from the culture? What kind of thoughts do you have on that subject from viewing this in the 16th century of Peru? And does it tell us anything about our spiritual life and meeting of different cultures today?
Wow. That's quite a question.
I'm good at asking these, you know, tough questions at the very end of our interviews. I like to get our scholars to, you know, speculate, to go beyond a little bit of their comfort zone and to think big in many ways.
Well, you know, anthropology is about taking other cultures seriously, mm-hmm. and believing that we can learn from ancient traditions like those of the Andes or elsewhere. It's about challenging, I think, the arrogance of thought that Europe and America have all the answers. And so when I look at Blas Valera, I see him in a very heroic light. I mean, 400 years ago, he did this. He dedicated himself to learning about the traditions of the Incas and to saying that their traditions and customs of South American Indians have value. And he wasn't alone. I mean, you have Matteo Ricci in China. You have Robert de Nobili in India, both Jesuits at the same time as Valera. They learned about and celebrated the wisdom and cultures of China and India, respectively. And I think in 2012 that this lesson, this need to say that, I don't know if you want to talk about in these terms, a successful global culture has to be one in which all peoples are respected, and that's more important than ever now. You know, since Vatican II, the Catholic Church has emphasized the idea of enculturation, of finding ways to found Christianity within native cultures. And Valera was doing this 400 years ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that I think we need to do. Again, as an anthropologist, it seems to me that we have to recognize that Western traditions, while completely valuable and important, are only a small piece of the entire human puzzle. And I think we have, well, as an anthropologist, I think we have to dedicate ourselves to recovering ancient cultural traditions and voices before they're gone.
Mm-hmm. Well, you do an excellent job of doing that. And again, I'm fascinated by your work because you are looking at Incan culture in and of itself, but also through the lens of Christianity, through the eyes of a mestizo. And as you continue your work on these beaded strings, the quipus, I think they're called,
mm-hmm.
You really are advancing that kind of knowledge, and the discoveries that you've been making are very worthwhile for our entire profession. So, Sabina, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion, and I want to point everybody back to our website so that they can check out your readings and the fascinating work that you're doing.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a great honor to be asked to be part of this program, and I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.